Blog Talk Radio.
And no matter where you've been or where you might currently find yourself, it's not over. When God is in it, there is no limit. New breed.
It's not over. It's not finished. It's not ending.
It's only the beginning.
It's only the beginning. And God is in there.
All things are new.
All things are
new. All things are new.
Not finished.
everyone, and welcome to another edition of Center Stage. I'm Carrie Hines, your host. Tonight you will hear the story of Carolyn Thomas. On December 5th, 2003, in Waco, Texas, her then-boyfriend of 8 years, Terrence Dwayne Kelly, shot and killed Carolyn's mother and then turned the gun on Carolyn, shooting her once in the face at point-blank range. She has an amazing story of survival, and we will hear from Carolyn in just a moment. But before we begin, we want to say to anyone who is suffering from domestic abuse, there is help. Contact the Domestic Abuse Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE or 1-800-799-7233. Now, ladies and gentlemen, help me welcome Center Stage, Ms. Carolyn Thomas. Good evening, Carolyn. How are you?
Hello.
Hi. Listen, before we talk about that tragic day when all of this happened, you know, a lot of times I've seen the interviews and I went back and I did the research. No one really seemed to ask you who you were before this all happened. Can you give us an idea of where you grew up and what type of person you were before all of this ever happened?
I grew up in West Texas, a town called Midland, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I was born and raised.
Okay.
And I was active in speech and drama in school and track and field, basketball, just all the sports. But my favorite was track and field.
And I understand you were raised by your mother and grandmother?
Yes.
And so it appears that in 1995, were you still in school when you met this Terrence Kelly?
No.
You were not. Okay, so it seems like at some, I understood it was at a parking lot somewhere you met him.
Yes, I was out looking for a job at the time. Me and a friend.
And what happened?
I said we were out looking for a job, me and one of my roommates.
And you met him. You know,
right.
From what I understand, he appeared to be shy to you.
Yes, he did.
So your first impression of him was what?
Just that he was shy and he didn't talk much.
So you were attracted to him because...
Actually, I wasn't attracted to him at all. It was just one of those, you know, why not, you know.
And so you began to date him.
Yes.
And you, the relationship, how did it begin?
We went on a date to the fair. It comes every year here in Waco in October.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I was at home just doing nothing, and he called and asked if I wanted to go.
Did you get any impressions from him when you began to date him that things would turn out the way they did? I mean, did he have any, you know, red flags that you saw early on?
No, not till we moved in together.
Okay. So when you moved in together, what happened?
He became, you know, controlling of what I wore and where I went.
I understand you described the relationship with him as you felt like you were caged from the outside world. Explain to us what that means.
The outside world didn't know what was, you know, really going on.
Mm-hmm.
I still, you know, smiled and joked around and hit the bruises, but nobody knew, really.
So your family didn't know that he was hitting you?
My uncle didn't know, and, you know, my mom kind of assumed. I never told anybody.
And, you know, and that's one thing I always wonder with domestic abuse victims. Why is it that you felt a need to hide it from? So, didn't you think somebody else needed to know just in case this thing went terribly wrong as it later did? Did you ever think I need to tell somebody just in case?
No.
Wow.
No.
And you said you experienced helplessness, powerlessness, isolation. You felt like he was controlling and manipulating you. You felt fear. You felt all those emotions, and you never thought, I better tell somebody.
No, you know, and it manifested into a dream, you know, that all that stuff was going on.
So you never told anybody, but, you know, I'm a Christian, and most folks who listen to the show know that. And, you know, one thing I know the Bible says is that warning comes before destruction. Was there any warning signs to you?
Yes. I mean, I kept having this repeated dream of him shooting me in the back.
No.
And I thought, you know, maybe it's, you know, just because I'm afraid of him, or is this like, is God trying to tell me something?
Now, did you have that over, you know, just before the incident occurred, or did you have it years in advance?
Years in advance.
Wow, that's incredible. And so this person, did his family, was his family aware that he was, you know, this monster to you? Did they know that he was being verbally and physically abusive to you?
Yes.
Wow. Wow. Did they intervene in any way?
I mean, his sister would. I don't know. I can't really just say too much about his mom.
Okay. I understand. And so, wow. Because I guess what I'm trying to do, and forgive me for doing this, but I think I don't understand one thing about domestic abuse, and that's the fear is always there that something could go wrong, but a lot of times, not always, but a lot of times people stay until things go bad like your situation did. So
right.
I always wonder, like in the back of your mind when you're constantly getting that bad feeling, you know, they say your gut doesn't fool you, why the indicator is not loud enough for you to say, I need to move away from this. Or why the, you know, anybody who's experiencing that, they don't feel like that sense of urgency to get out.
You just really don't think that it's going to happen.
That's
like, you just can't believe this person who says they love you, but, you know, they could do something so awful.
I think I read somewhere where you said you confused love with jealousy with love.
Yeah.
Explain that.
Well, he was very, you know, jealous. You know, of course, he had me dressing more like a guy than in women's clothing and, like, tennis shoes and stuff. And, you know, I could only hang around his friend's girlfriend.
I think you said you were not even allowed to have any male friends, or you couldn't even talk
to
male cousins?
Not even cousins. Like, for real, like, he did not believe that the people were my cousins. And my grandfather is originally from Waco.
Okay. So all of this is going on, and the relationship was like an 8-year relationship. But during that 8 years, he went to prison. He got in trouble, and he went to prison. And I understand the relationship was from, like, 92 to 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere in that period, he went to prison. And,
yes.
And you, when he went to prison, how did you feel once, you know, you felt like, okay, he's in prison now? How did that make you feel?
I was happy that he was in prison. But, you know, he wouldn't let me stay by myself. I had to go live with his mother.
You had to go stay with his mother. So you still felt he was controlling you even in prison?
Yeah, I mean, at that point, he had been saying that I will kill you, you know, often.
Okay. And so you stayed with his mother while he was in prison. So were you thinking, I want to get out, or were you thinking when he gets out, we're just going
to
pick up?
Oh, of course I wanted to get out. I just didn't know how.
Okay. I'm just trying to establish, like, you know, what was going on with this whole thing. And so he's in prison for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so during the time that he's in prison, I understand he's writing you letters.
Yes.
What is he saying in the letters?
You know, I can't really just say. I just remember how he signed them, like, together forever, till death do us part.
So each of his letters were signed together forever, to death do us part. Is that something he also said when he was out as well? That y'all would be together until death did you part?
Sometimes, but not as often as the, if you leave me, I'll kill you.
Okay. Because I'm just trying to, you know, establish, you know, to in my own head and into the listeners, for them to understand and myself to understand as well, you know, did this build up over a period of time where the warning signs were just missed, or was this just an isolated incident where this person just freaked and for whatever reason and did this unthinkable crime? But we're gonna hear the story in just a minute. But I think his mother, I think you told of incidents where you and him were fighting in the pre-interview, and you actually pulled a gun on each other at one point?
Yes.
What was going on that day?
Him just being jealous of somebody coming by to look for him. And I told him that, you know, this person came by. And I don't know, just for some reason he thought or assumed that the guy liked me or that I liked the guy, and it just escalated.
It just escalated. Wow. And so at the point in which you all pulled the gun on each other, how did that situation resolve itself where no one got killed that particular time?
Well, there was a friend of his there.
So the friend talked him out of, you know,
put the guns down, yeah.
So in the relationship, at any point did you ever leave the relationship? Did you ever get out?
Several times.
So at some point during the relationship, it seems that you knew this is not working and you got out. What made you go back?
He would always say, you know, I won't do it again, I love you, you know, those type of things like most abusers say.
Did at one time his mother even help him to talk you into coming back to him?
Right, yes, she did.
What did she say?
As always, you know, he didn't mean to do it.
Did you believe her?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's his mother.
What kind of relationship did he have with his mother? Can you tell us that at all, or is that something we can't talk about?
To me, they had a good relationship. I mean, you know, she spoiled him.
Okay. So I understand that one Easter, you all were fighting, and the mother was present. What happened that Easter?
It was because I had dyed my hair, and he got angry because of the color that I dyed it, which was blonde.
And what was wrong with your hair being blonde?
Well, he said that's the color that, you know, sluts and whores wore.
Hmm. So he would even feel like he had the power over what color you put on your hair.
Right.
Wow. Okay. So all this is established, and I understand that the day that the incident occurred on Easter where his mother was present, you all were fighting, and the mother actually said something at some point about y'all fighting?
Talking about on Easter?
Yeah.
it was about us had, you know, while we were fighting, we fell on our head, and that was what she was most concerned about.
So the two of you all are knocked down, drag out, like tussling, and y'all happened to fall on her hat. She didn't say y'all stop fighting at any point. She just said, y'all get off my hat.
Right.
Okay, wow. So that kind of tells me a little bit about, you know, where that situation was at with the mother. So fast forward to the day of the incident. What kind of day was it?
It was just a normal day. I mean, it didn't seem any different than any other day, just that he asked me to give him a ride somewhere.
Okay. So he asked you to take him somewhere. Where did you take him?
To Fort Worth, Texas.
Okay, you took him to Fort Worth, Texas. And you all lived in Waco at the time, so that's about 80 miles from Fort Worth?
Yes, I lived in Waco. I'm not sure where he was supposed to be living.
Okay, so at this particular time, then let's clear something out there. He had been to prison, and he was supposed to serve 8 years, but he only served three. And he got out, and at this point, you don't know where he's living, but he asked you for a ride to his sister's house.
Well, he was living in Fort Worth with his sister. That's where he was originally paroled to, but over the course of Thanksgiving, because it was like October the 3rd when he got out, and when Thanksgiving came around and his family came to Waco, he just chose not to go back. So that's what the ride to Fort Worth was about, to see if he could stay in Waco or did he have to reside in Fort Worth with his sister.
Okay. So you take him to Fort Worth. Everything is fine on the ride to Fort Worth. And then some kind of way you end up bringing him back to Waco?
Well, I assume that's what the man said, that he could go back to Waco. He didn't tell me any different. He just said, I need to go by my sister's and get my clothes, and that's where I took him.
Okay. So you take him to Fort Worth, and you all come back. The ride in the car both ways is okay? There's no tension? There's no nothing going on?
No.
Okay. So you all get back. And I understand your mother, was she living with you? Janice Reeves was your mother. She was living with you at the time. She had gone out to get something to eat, and she was back at the apartment when you all got back?
Well, she went to get something to eat after I got there.
Okay. So you and him got back, and you came into the apartment, and then your mother went to get something to eat and came back.
Right.
Okay, so he did not come into the apartment with you when you first came in?
Yes, he did.
He did. Okay. But at some point he leaves and then comes back.
Right.
Right. Okay, so let's fast forward. Your mother's back in the apartment, you're back in the apartment, and then he comes back into the apartment. What happens at that point?
I don't know. His whole demeanor just changed, and he went to screaming and yelling about somebody being in the apartment.
So is he talking about a specific person being in the apartment, or is he just saying he thinks somebody, as in maybe the police or a mysterious person?
That's what we don't know right now today, is that who he was talking about, because there was nobody in there.
Okay, so he never specified who he was talking about. He just felt somebody was in the apartment.
Right.
Okay, so you and your mother were assuring him that no one else was there, correct?
Right.
And then what happened?
There was a gun that he had when he went to prison. I basically didn't know what to do with the gun. It was in the shoebox under the bed, and he got it.
Okay. So he gets the gun from under the bed because he's believing that somebody's in a paranoid state, and he's feeling that somebody is in the house or the apartment. And then he does what?
And then he shoots one time in the ceiling, maybe once or twice in the floor of my apartment, And
did you live in a story apartment? I mean, did you live in the second floor of an apartment building?
I live upstairs, and somebody lived downstairs.
Wow. So he's shooting down, which meant he could have hit people in the downstairs apartment as well.
Yes.
Okay. So he's shooting, and then what happened?
And he pointed the gun at my mom. I tried to grab it from him. He gained control and shot her in the stomach.
So you and he at one point actually were tussling over the gun?
Right.
Wow. And so is your mother saying anything to him at this point where he's pointing the gun at her?
I mean, I can't really say. It was just, you know,
it was so
going. I don't can't recall if she said something.
It's just a lot of confusion, I'm sure. And so at the point that he shoots your mother, what are you thinking? I mean, were you like...
I mean, it all just goes so fast from then. You know, next thing I remember, I'm on the floor and my face feels funny.
So at this point, your mother has been shot in the stomach and he has taken you from that room and drug you into another room and shot you in the face.
Right.
Okay. What happens at that point?
I mean, I noticed that my face feels funny. I hear my mom asking about where the phone is. And in my mind, I'm telling her that I don't know.
Was this a cordless phone you all were looking for?
Yes.
Okay. And so the cordless phone, y'all couldn't find, maybe it was off the set, off the headset or something, but you all didn't know at the time that he had actually taken the phone with him. Okay,
yes.
So he's left the apartment. Both of you all have been shot. How do you call 911?
We don't. The lady downstairs calls 911.
Okay. I understand your mother was able to crawl into the hallway of the apartment.
Right, yes.
Okay. So is that how the neighbor discovered that there was something going on, or was it the gunshots that gave him a clue that was something going on that wasn't right?
I really don't know.
Okay. But anyway, the neighbor called the police.
Yes.
Oh. I mean, this story is just, y'all don't know. I'm fighting to get through it because it's just, it tore me up today, just trying to piece together how this happened, and it was just such an incredible story. I just can't wrap my mind around what went wrong that day. So the police get there pretty quickly, and when they get there, they discover your mother in the hallway.
Right.
And then they come into the apartment, and they begin to try to clear the apartment to make certain that he's not in there.
Right, yes.
And what happens at that point?
And it's the officers, second time stepping over me, and I grabbed his leg to let him know I was alive.
Wait, so the officers are clearing the apartment, and they're assuming that you're deceased?
Yes.
So they never check you at first to see if you were okay. They just assume, looking at the condition of, the shooting of the shot.
Well, the officers... first thing to do when you get on the scene is to secure the area. So he was making sure, the first thing for him to do was to make sure Terrence wasn't in there.
Gotcha. And so when he's coming back the second time, you grab his leg.
Yes.
What did he say?
I mean, it scared him to death.
Mm.
Really bad. It scared him.
Wow. Okay, y'all. This story only gets worse from here. But before we continue, let me remind you, if you just tuned in, you come center stage tonight for the Carolyn Thomas story. She is a domestic violence survivor who survived a gunshot to the face at point-blank range. Her story has been featured on Oprah, Larry King Live, The Insider, our local Channel 8, KWTV in Waco, Temple, and Killeen, as well as in print with People Magazine, Jet, The Associated Press, The Dallas Morning News, and many others. So Carolyn's story, we're so glad she decided to share it with us tonight. And we also want to say to anyone that may be listening and suffering from domestic abuse tonight, reach out and get help. The domestic abuse hotline is 1-800-799-SAFE or 1-800-799-7233. Tonight's segment of Center Stage is being brought to you by African American News and Commentary Blog, your single source for news, events, and commentary that is of unique interest to African Americans. They're located on the web at www.africanamericannewsandcommentary.com. If you're trying to get in the chat room tonight, I want to remind you the chat room is closed. So if you have a question, Carolyn has agreed to take questions tonight. So if you have a question for this guest, you can get on the phone lines and dial us up at 347-850-8390. Again, the chat room is down tonight. But if you have a question for Carolyn tonight, if you're a sufferer of domestic abuse and you have questions and you want to talk to somebody who's been where you are, Carolyn is willing to take your call tonight. The phone number is 347-850-8390. So, Carolyn, at this point, you have touched your face, and it feels somewhat like a sponge is how you described it to me. So what happens after that? You've been shot in the face at point-blank range. Your mother has been shot in the stomach. To your knowledge, she's crawled into the hallway to get you help. And so what happens at that point?
I really, you know, don't remember too much of that, but I know that my uncle told me I went to our local hospital here in Waco and then was later airlifted to Scott & White in Temple, Texas.
Okay. And I understand that they caught Terrence like 20 minutes after the incident.
Yeah.
And what I read was that after he shot your mother and then you, he went, I guess, to wherever his mother was and attempted to shoot her as well?
Right.
Does anybody know what that was about?
No, not really.
Okay. And then I understand at this point he is buck naked and jumps into a fire truck?
Right.
Okay. So it has been said that he was on a drug called Wet. What is Wet?
Right. Supposedly marijuana and embalming fluid.
Okay. And I saw the interview in which he did with Oprah's people, and he said something to the effect that all he had smoked was a Black & Mild.
Right.
You know, he didn't say the Black & Mild was laced with anything. He just said he found a Black & Mild in an ashtray. He didn't say where the ashtray was, but that he found a half-smoked Black & Mild cigarette, and he smoked that. That's all he said.
Oh. Well, I don't, you know, my mom and I smoked Blacks, but I don't know where he would get a laced one at. It definitely wasn't in our apartment.
Mm. Okay. So you go to the hospital, and I'm sure, you know, you don't know the extent of your injuries at this point. But when you get to the hospital and you finally are conscious and you see your family, what was that scene like?
I mean, I just wanted to know where my mom was.
Wow. So you looked around and your mother wasn't there, but other people in the family were, and you were wanting to know where she was. What did they tell you?
Well, I mean, my father told me that she didn't make it.
How hard was that first hearing it?
That was really hard. I remember going into convulsions and, you know, my eyes rolling back in my head. It was really hard to hear that.
And I understand that you have, I think they've gone through a combination of grief, guilt, and I forgot what the other emotion was, but you've experienced them all.
Yes.
Why is that?
Because I blame myself for my mother's death.
Did you ever get past that?
Yes, I did.
So you're in the hospital and you're trying to recover and they have your mother's funeral. Are you able to go?
No, I was not.
Wow. And so I'm sure the stress is taking its toll on your family. You're in the hospital and probably, you know, by all indicators, I understand, was not expected to make it, and your mother has already passed. How is the rest of the family doing?
I mean, they're okay. They're trying to stand strong, but my grandfather ended up passing away as well as my aunt.
Due to the stress of all of this?
I believe so.
Wow. And so your grandfather passes away shortly after your mother, and were you able to attend his funeral?
No.
Wow. So you're still in the hospital recuperating, and I understand you were your face was so severely damaged that you lost 80% of your face?
Yes.
Wow. What all was damaged?
The right eye, the nose, the upper lip, and some of the jaw on the left side.
Mm. I understand it was 4 weeks in the hospital before you actually saw what the face looked like post the shooting. How was that for you?
It was pretty rough.
Can you describe to us what you saw, if it's not too graphic, can you describe to us what you saw when you first looked in the mirror?
I mean, it's hard to explain. It was just like a bunch of empty space. Like, there was nothing there. You can just imagine nothing being there, and where your nose and your eye and all that was, it's just empty.
Have the doctors been able to explain how you even survived seeing that so much of your face was taken off?
No, I haven't had one explain it to me.
I agree it was God. I was trying to rationalize it in my head as I was reading one of the articles that I think it said the shot was taking, I think the hit came to like your left eye and everything below that or something to that effect.
Yes.
So I was trying to rationalize, well, maybe it's because it didn't hit the brain, you know, or maybe it was because, did the doctors ever say that?
No.
No, okay. I was just rationalizing. But I think I'm of the liking that you are correct. It was the grace of God, that you had a purpose here, and that's to share your story with the rest of us so that maybe you can save someone else from going through what you went through. So, you know, just your story was just so incredible. Understand they had to put a tracheotomy in your throat and
yes.
That you were being fed through a feeding tube?
Right.
Wow. How long did you have to endure that?
The feeding tube was probably about 2 years.
Okay. And so when you began to get a little better, because I understand you were in the hospital for quite some time, how long were you in the hospital?
About 6 months.
6 months. So being in a hospital, it kind of is a cocoon, I would think, type of experience, because you really didn't have to deal with the whole world. You just had to deal with whoever you encountered at the hospital. How was
right.
it when you first left the hospital and getting back into the real world with the rest of us? What type of experiences have you had since then?
I mean, people staring and looking, you know, wondering what happened, or is that the young lady that was on TV? I mean, those were the type of looks that I got.
You know, you told me a story in the pre-interview about going into your neighborhood HEB after you got out of the hospital. Tell us about that.
Well, I was shopping, and I grew up in a Spanish neighborhood, so I kind of know a little bit of Spanish, and the Hispanic guy and his son were shopping, and the little boy says, "Cucuy, daddy, cucuy," and that's monster in Spanish.
Wow. So, now, if they had said that to me, I wouldn't have even known what it was, but... Yeah, I wouldn't, because my Spanish is poor. But how badly did it hurt to know what he said?
It hurt bad.
Yeah.
I mean, if that's, you know, what kids see when they would see me, yeah, I felt bad.
And we know that children, you know, in a lot of instances, they say things because they just don't know any better. But have you received cruel remarks from adults as well?
Yes, I have.
Wow. How do you handle it?
I mean, some of them I handle pretty good and some of them I don't. You know, it just depends on the day.
I can imagine. You know, and I would think that with this, you would have your bouts of depression. Have you?
Yes, I have.
How do you deal with that?
Well, at first I started off with the medication, and then after a while I just kind of gradually got away from the medication.
And
a lot of praying, you know.
Yeah. And I'm sure you had a lot of people praying for you. And one person I want to mention at this time is your uncle. Your uncle was, like, very instrumental and helping you get through this. Tell us the things that your uncle did after the shooting.
He would come and visit me, you know, every day or every other day. Being that I was in the hospital during the Christmas, you know, he put up a Christmas tree and brought me gifts. And him and his wife at the time decorated my room, you know, made it comfortable. Actually, you know, I had a rug and comforter and I had everything except for curtains hanging up.
Wow. So he wanted you to feel like you were at home.
Right.
So you got through the hospital experience and, you know, have you sat down in your quiet moments and rethought over, I would assume over and over in your head, how did you get here? Did you ever try to figure out how did things go so wrong?
Yeah, things went wrong because I just tried to be cordial with him, and I didn't have a plan. Like, I didn't have a safety plan, and sometimes that's what you need is a plan.
I understand when he first got in trouble with drugs, or the incident that you were aware of, that he first got into trouble with drugs, that a police officer told you to get away from him, that he wasn't.
Yeah.
So in hindsight, that was like a second or third warning, because I think you said your mother and your grandmother picked up some bad vibes about him as well.
Right, they did. Yes.
What did your mother sense?
She just thought he was controlling.
Mm. And your grandmother?
Crazy.
So were you in love, or were you just in love with the fact that you were in a relationship? Because I just find it hard to believe that you can really love somebody who is controlling you and being verbally and physically abusive to you. Was it really love, or was it just the idea of being
a mixture of love and fear. Like, you know, when I think about it now, I think to myself, like, how could I really love somebody like that? And in my speeches, I don't mention that I love him. I speak of him in the incident, mm-hmm. but a lot of people have noticed I've never said I love him.
Mm. But you, do you think it was love?
In the beginning, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I would think, you know, over a period of 8 years and someone with all the ups and downs and the hitting and the fussing and the arguing and the controlling, that love becomes that fine line that you hear people talk about, that fine line between love and hate. Did y'all
right.
ever, I mean, did you ever border on that where you just was sick and tired of being sick and tired of what was going on?
Yeah, and then I would leave and he would apologize and I would end up going back.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing that people don't understand about women in domestic violence. The question is, why do they always go back?
What's the answer?
Well, most of the men always apologize and say they're not going to do it again, and for a period of time they don't.
Hmm. Wow. I heard his interview, which I was very shocked by, and he said he hurts every day over what he did, that he loved you and your mother.
Uh-huh.
Does he really think love shoots people?
I don't know.
Terrence is... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. You what?
No, you're fine. I was just saying Terrence is a mess. Like, that whole interview was a mess.
It seemed like it was almost like an ego, maybe, thing to appear on Oprah, because he didn't seem to really answer any questions in a way that made any sense.
No, that's right.
It just seems like he was there, but he, you know, he said that he had prayed to God for forgiveness, you know, over the incident, and, you know, that he loved you and your mother. And I just found that, like, that just didn't add up.
Right.
Do you feel like you're stronger as a result of what happened?
Oh, yeah, I do. I do. I would have to be.
Yeah. Yeah. But there has to be moments when, I shouldn't assume that, but I would think that there would have to be moments when you had to pray just for sanity.
Oh, yeah. Because I was always dealing with my mom's death and dealing with looking different, and it was rough.
Why do you think God allowed it to happen to you?
To learn a life lesson.
Mm. Well, I mean, you and I both know you would have preferred probably a life lesson a lot than
yeah,
the one you went through.
You know, but
so you really think it was just a life?
Sometimes you got to let the bullfrog bump its butt is what my grandma used to say.
Wow. Oh, wow. You know, and I hear you, but I'm like, wow, because, you know, I would just be thinking, Lord, pass this cup for me. But it, I think, too, you know, in talking to you, you're one of the strongest people I've ever talked to, and I have to admit that, because your spirit is still strong, which seems to be something he was not able to break despite what you went through.
Right.
But if you had a do-over, of course, you probably would... To say no.
Yeah.
So have you spoken to his family since this incident?
No. I see his daughters every now and then, or may speak with them on Facebook.
Mm-hmm. They didn't visit you at all after, you know, after the incident?
His daughters, no, but I've seen them.
No, I mean,
you know,
his family. Any of
them.
Any of his family?
His mom and sister did visit me one time.
Really? How was that?
Well, they had brought some pictures of him and I, and his mother was saying, you know, he didn't mean to do it. He loved you. And I think I cracked up and lost it and kicked him out of the room.
So she thought... With what you were going through, a smart thing to do was to bring pictures of you and him
right.
pre the shooting and tell you that he loved you?
I guess so. That's what she did.
That speaks volumes, folks. I'm sorry, that speaks volumes for where her mind was in a situation like that. I guess I'm trying to understand, at some point, was there ever an intervention where somebody, after stuff start getting kind of crazy on either side, your side of the family or his side of the family, where, you know, you don't necessarily have to tell people sometime about domestic abuse, they can see it for themselves. Did anybody see it and say, hey, this is not good for you?
No, I mean, if they did, they didn't say anything.
So Uncle Milton Robinson, the uncle, he never saw it? Your uncle?
Well, I'm sure he did, but he, you know, like you said, he didn't know until, like, the last minute.
And you know, the amazing thing is you today teach other women how not to go through what you went through. Do you see people who were exactly where you were then?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Wow. What do you say to them?
I mean, I kind of just tell them my story and show them pictures of me, you know, before I got shot and what I look like without the bandages and before surgery. Some people I reach, some people I don't.
You know, and I thought it was courageous of you. I think I read in the People magazine article that you said you were doing, I think, photo shoots or posters or something to show people as like a campaign to like, you know, kind of promote, you know, domestic or, and, you know, basically speak out against domestic violence is what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
So you said that you call yourself a great visual aid for women in abusive relationships. Explain that.
A visual aid of what you could look like if you stay in that relationship.
How
like
hard
the outcome
is it?
Would be.
I'm sorry?
I said just a visual aid of what the outcome could be if you continue to stay.
How hard is it for you to walk away when you talk to someone, because you do interventions with people who are going through what you're going through today. How hard is it to try to intervene for someone who's going through what you went through, and you see the warning signs there, and they don't heed the call?
It's pretty rough. Like, it's aggravating, but you can't give up on them. You know, you have to just continue telling them, you know, what the outcome could be. You just can't give up on it.
You can't give up on them, and that's incredible. Now, are these women, when they're asking for interventions, are their partners aware that they're doing it, or is this something they secretly do when they meet with you, or how does that go?
Sometimes it may be a sister who's doing it for, you know, another sister, or it could be a mom doing it for a daughter. It just depends.
Because, you know, in your situation, you talk about fighting back. A lot of women don't even fight back. Is that a smart thing to do?
I mean, I don't think so. I mean, you know, but you got women that will defend themselves, and, you know, it could escalate into something. I just, you know, you just never know what you'll do in the moment. So I can't say what's right and what's wrong.
Well, I agree with that. I agree with that. It's individual. But, you know, in the situation over the course of the 8 years when he was, you know, verbally abusive, was he apologetic after the fact?
Oh, yeah. They always all apologize.
Did you believe him?
I mean, at one point I did, and after a while it just seemed like it just became words.
Just words. just worse. Y'all, if you just tuned in, you've come center stage tonight for the Carolyn Thomas story. She is a domestic violence survivor. She survived a gunshot to the face at point-blank range. Her story has been featured on Oprah, Larry King Live, The Insider, our local Channel 8 here in Dallas-Fort Worth, KWTX, Waco, Temple, and Killeen, as well as in print with the Dallas Morning News, People Magazine, Jet Magazine, The Associated Press, and many others. We're so glad that she decided to share her story tonight because we want to get the word out. If you are a victim of domestic abuse, there is help. Contact the Domestic Abuse Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE or 1-800-799-7233. Carolyn, what is your advice for someone who's dealing with domestic, you know, abuse right now? What do you tell them? I mean, do you tell them to leave immediately or have an escape plan? Or what is the plan of action, seeing that when your boyfriend was in jail for the 3 years, you did not get an escape plan in place before he got out? What do you tell them about an escape plan?
I would say, you know, get an escape plan. Call your local shelter or the domestic violence hotline number, you know, and they'll help you come up with a plan and, you know, where to go and what to do.
A safe way to get out.
You got to watch who you tell. Yeah, most definitely. A safe way to get out.
And you said watch who you tell. Explain that.
Well, there may be certain people that you don't want to tell that the abuser can pick them. You know, and kind of find out, so you don't want to tell too many people where you're going and what you're doing.
That's good advice. Let's take a phone call. Let's go to area code 682-561. Good evening. You're on center stage.
Carrie, I am really enjoying this show, and, you know, I just want to let you know that I really, really love the show tonight. This is some really good, I think this is really good information for a lot of the women out there. But I do, and I've been listening to the show since you first got on, Carrie, but I do got a question for her. You were saying earlier that when you first got into the relationship that he was very controlling. To me, that would have been a sign right there that it's time to leave. You didn't see a sign that it was time for you to leave a relationship in the early beginning of the relationship?
Well, the controlling really came in when we moved in together. And that's when he started trying to change the way I dress and who I hung out with. And like I said, I thought that the jealousy was a form of love. So, yeah, I had it all confused and mixed up. I mean, I'm human. What can I say?
Would you tell other women out there that may be getting into a first-time relationship that they, soon as they start being controlled, that that's a sign that they need to get out of the relationship?
Yes, most definitely. That is definitely a red flag, yes.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And, again, Carrie, you're doing a wonderful job. I'm really enjoying the show. And keep up the wonderful good work that you're doing, Carrie.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right.
You know, and I was, you know, thinking as he was talking, was Terrence Kelly abusive on a daily basis?
No, just, you know, certain occasions. It would be certain things that would set him off.
So when people think of abuse, you know, some women may think, well, he doesn't hit me all the time, or he maybe only hits me every 3 months. That's still not an excuse to stay, correct?
No, it's not.
Okay. So it would just be certain things that would set him off. Were there triggers that would send him into a rage?
I mean, most of the time it would be, like, jealousy things. Like, I remember seeing one of his friends somewhere, and he said, well, you know, I just went by the house or whatever, and just tell him that I'm looking for him. And so when I told him that, I mean, he freaked out. Like, he would get mad because I would leave soap on my neck. I mean, you know, how crazy is that?
Soap as in, like, soap
like
that
you
wash
shower,
with? Oh, wow.
And you, like, say you shower and you know, you may have a little soap on your neck when you get out.
Hmm. Okay. So it just sounds like, too, he was controlling, but he was also mean.
Right.
I mean, I'm sorry. That just sounds very mean to I mean,
right.
It would just seem like the logical thing would be to say, hey, baby, you got some soap on your neck. You bet you
right.
missed. That
right.
would send
no,
him into
really
a physical altercation?
Sometimes. I mean, it really, that was something that just really agitated, and I just find that crazy. But, yeah, it did.
Wow. Interesting. So, you know, when he went to court, was there a defense that he put up? I mean, did he say he was insane? I mean, what was his
I think he tried to say he was crazy.
Okay, he did try that.
Yes.
Okay. So I understand that that didn't work too well and that the jury came back pretty quickly with their verdict. How long
right.
did it take the jury to deliberate?
I'm not really sure because that stuff back then is such a blur to me right now. I don't think it really took long, maybe a couple of hours.
I heard 20 minutes. I read 20 minutes.
Wow,
I was like,
okay.
I read 20 minutes in People Magazine, and I thought, oh, my God. So it sounds like, you know, that it, you know, it was obviously pretty clear to the jury that this guy should not get out. But when you were, you know, I understand that, you know, you went to trial every day. Did you actually have to testify?
Uh-huh. No, I didn't. And I wasn't in the courtroom every day, just on the day that I needed to give my testimony.
Oh, so you didn't go every day. You just went the one day that you testified.
Well, I went every day, but I didn't go into the actual courtroom
gotcha.
Until I had to testify.
Gotcha. And I understand when you had to testify, your attorney was so smart that he put a big box of Kleenex in front of you so that you didn't have to look directly at him.
Right, like it was super-sized box of tissue.
Wow. Is it because you couldn't face him or you felt like you would get too emotional, or why did he feel you needed to have that there?
I don't know. It was very smart, but whatever, it worked.
Okay, so it calmed you enough to be able to get your testimony out and do what you had to do.
Right.
Wow. You know, looking back, and they say hindsight is 20/20. What were the warning signs that things were going to eventually turn deadly?
I would just say, you know, over the years of him continuously telling me that if I leave him, he would kill me.
And you say today, if someone tells you that they're going to kill you, that you should what?
Take it very seriously. I don't care if they're smiling and showing you top and bottom teeth. Take it serious.
Is it true that your mother, when she had you, she was like 16, correct?
Yeah, she was pretty young.
She was pretty young. And so you, over the course of your early years, saw her suffer from domestic abuse. Is that correct?
Right.
So do you think that is maybe a reason why you were so tolerant and stayed so long in your relationship?
I think maybe it had a little something to do with it. I mean, sometimes we can become a product of our environment, and we never talked about it. You know, they never said it's wrong, and, you know, that's something that a lady shouldn't allow a man to do. So we never talked about it.
Okay. So your mother and you never had – so your mother and you were living together at one point, at the point of the incident, y'all were living together. Was he ever abusive towards you in front of your mother?
No. I can't say that he was.
So she never actually saw it. So that may be
no.
why she never – okay, gotcha. Wow. So I don't know, looking back – at the day of the incident, I can't believe that there wasn't some tension somewhere. Do you think you just missed it?
I know, that is just really, that's really weird. No tension. In the car going, in the car on the way back. And I just, you know, I had heard that they're, you know, they're in prison. They go to the barbershop, and he told the guy there that cuts hair that when he got out, he was going to kill me and my mother. So I think by him doing that drug, which just gave him, you know, that added edge to do something that he said he was going to do all along.
So in the 3 years that he was in prison, during that time, somewhere during that time, he told someone that he was going to kill you and your mother.
Right.
Wow. Did that person come forward after the whole incident? Or did
he testified,
okay,
my understanding.
Wow. Because, it's just so many things about him that seem so out of the norm. He just seemed like an odd. Yeah, he just seems like an odd type person.
Yeah, he was odd. The type of guy, I mean, he was not the type of guy that I would date at all, period.
So going back to the jury, coming back in 20 minutes, what kind of sentence did they give him for his crime?
He got, like, 2 life sentences, and each sentence carries 30 years before he can come up for parole. So he has to do, like, 60 years.
So he won't see the light of day anymore.
Oh, no, ma'am.
Did you think during the time, during that 8 years, that you could change this person? Did you ever have that
fantasy? Yeah, that was one of the things, you know. I wanted him to be the type of gentleman, you know, like my grandfather. And, I, you know, after going through counseling, I learned you can't change nobody. All you can do is change yourself.
So you thought he just needed to get a job or decent job.
And get a job and a whole lot of praying. And sometimes, you know, some people need a little more than just some prayer.
But you said the day that the shooting occurred, he looked like the devil when you looked at him after he shot your mom. Describe the look on his face after he did that.
Like nobody's home, just like the eyes was just black, like, you know that eerie feeling that you, if you ever got it when you're home alone and it feels like somebody in there, but you know there's nobody there but just you.
That's how you felt.
Right. But I seen it.
So he looked like the devil, so he was just totally enraged to a point there was no bringing him down.
No bringing him down, no matter what I said.
You know, looking back at, you know, at your story and going over it, you know, in my head the last couple of days, I can only imagine being in that hospital room over that period of time and, you know, knowing that your mother had passed. How many times did you replay woulda, coulda, shoulda? How many times did you replay that?
Oh, my God. How many times? I mean, I still replay that woulda, coulda, shoulda.
Really?
In my head. But, you know, like I said, I had some wonderful people in my life, wonderful counselor that went above and beyond her means. And, you know, I didn't pull that trigger. Terrence pulled that trigger.
True.
So I did not kill her. He killed her.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's very true. You described that day as having an out-of-body experience when he shot you and that you asked God to forgive you of your sins. Tell us about that.
That was really weird. I've, you know, talked about it several times, you know, with different doctors, and they say that it's lack of oxygen to the brain.
Mm-hmm.
But when you can feel, like, the presence of God and you know that that feels good and that it's right, and then you can feel the presence of the devil and you know that's wrong, and in the midst of falling down the tunnel with the light, I just said, God, forgive me for all my sins. And that's when I woke up and heard my mother asking where the phone was.
Wow. So you felt like you were slipping away.
Oh, yeah, I was dying, and the devil and God was battling over my soul.
You really felt that?
And when I asked God to forgive me, I came back.
Mm. So you feel that this whole thing happened, why?
You know, I don't know the reason, you know, why it happened, but, you know, I'm going to try to prevent it from happening to somebody else. Somebody else going through what I went through. Somebody else not listening when you got family or friends trying to tell you something. I just think that's, you know, why I survived. I have a purpose.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I absolutely agree. You know, you are, like I said, one of the most courageous people I have ever talked to, and you've given me new hope on things that I thought I couldn't get through. I felt like, well, you know, I how dare I say I can't make it if she made it through what she made it through. And, you know, I saw on the Oprah interview, I believe it was, where you said you wanted to go face-to-face with this guy and talk to him about the incident itself. Did you really?
Yeah, I wanted to do a mediation. That's something that you do through the prison system, and you're only allowed to talk about, you know, that event, what happened that night. And it's you and a counselor and a prison guard. And I just thought maybe I would get some of my questions in.
And I'm almost at loss for words. What would you want to say to him?
Like, where did you get the drug? And, you know, why would you do, you know, that type of drug? And, you know, why would you shoot my mom? Just a lot of stuff.
I understand he refused it.
Yes, he did.
Did he give you a reason why he refused?
I mean, no, they didn't give me a reason. They just say that a lot of times it takes people 10 to 20 years before they want to even talk about it or admit, you know, to, you know, what happened. So.
Wow. So you think he's still in somewhat of a state of denial?
Yeah.
Really? So, and I think I have to agree with you because he's not accepting total responsibility for what he did. He's saying he's sorry, but at the same time, you know, when I saw the Oprah interview, it was like, I don't remember anything. I just, you know,
yeah.
I smoked a Black and Mild and, you know, it's kind of like I woke up out of a haze and all this had happened. It just seemed like he wasn't accepting responsibility.
No, he didn't.
Mm. So, when you saw him in court for the brief time that you did see him, what kind of emotions rose up in you when you saw him?
I mean, I just got angry and, you know, emotional, but I had to get it together because I chose to give, like, a victim's impact statement, and I wanted it to be heard. I didn't want to be, you know, sobbing through it. I wanted to get my point across to him, and that was the only and final time that I would have to do it, so I had to suck it up and give the victim's impact statement.
And can you tell us a little of what you said in your victim's impact statement?
Just a little bit of how, you know, he had power and control over me and how he does it now and I'm taking back my life and just, you know, different things.
Mm. Did you ever look him eyeball to eyeball that day?
I remember, excuse me, seeing him leave out of the courtroom and him saying to us, the people that were in the seats, that he would be out in 2 years.
No, he was not that mean.
Yeah, he watched a little bit too much of Nino Brown, I think.
So he looked at you all and said that as though he hadn't done anything wrong.
Right. Like, you know, like he just had this high-powered attorney and, you know, he still is above the law.
Hmm. Wow. Maybe that's why he got 60 years, because he did that. You know, maybe that know. Just infuriated the jury to the point, I don't know, I'm assuming, that if he thinks he, you know, it, because I would not feel comfortable with someone like that being on the street. I mean, because it seems like
right.
he has a violent tendency. I mean, because mm-hmm. if you can shoot two people and you can't even explain why, then I would be afraid for that type of person to be walking the street
right.
again. Have you forgiven him?
Yeah, and it took some time to be able to forgive him, but I learned that, you know, if I don't or if I didn't forgive him, then I wouldn't be able to heal myself. Like, I would just be this angry, bitter person.
Yeah, yeah. And you do not seem like that at all. You don't. I've talked to her, yeah. I don't sense that. How important was the counseling?
It was really important. Like, I had an amazing counselor. She found out about the organization's Face-to-Face, which does reconstructive surgery for women of domestic violence, you know, from the neck up. And then another wonderful organization called Give Back a Smile, which they will repair your smile zone. And so she was like the key person in me getting my, you know, my reconstructive surgery started.
Mm. You know, and in doing this, you know, you chose not to be a victim, and you've chosen to instead turn this into somewhat of what I would call a ministry. How easy is it to relive this story over and over to help somebody else not go through what you've gone through? How easy or how hard is it to relive?
I mean, it
that?
Was really hard in the beginning. I would get teared up and go to crying, but now it's more of a. I mean, I don't know how to explain it. Like, I just know that by me crying and getting teared up is not going to get my point across. Like, I'm trying to get a point across and a clear understanding of what happened to me and what could happen to whomever I'm speaking with.
So it's important.
I mean, I have those days, of course, you know, that I have those crying spells. But for the most part, given my speech or talking to, I try not to do that.
Is it a trigger that sets off the crying spells, or can it just be anything?
Just my mom. You know, me and my mother, we were really close, and, you know, she was my mom, my best friend. She was my everything. So, you know, Christmas, especially around that time of year, and her birthday, which is, like, right after that, and, you know, it's rough.
Mm.
So I'm kind of, like, from December to February, I'm kind of just like shut down.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. And this many years later, you haven't been able to push past that?
No, I mean, it's hard. I don't think, you know, whether, you know, your mother got shot or whether she died of natural causes or what have you, you still miss
Free.
That person, you know?
Do you feel like you didn't get closure because it happened the way it happened and so and not being able to go to the funeral? Do you think you didn't get closure, you know, with your mother's situation?
I mean, I think I did later on through the course of counseling. I mean, my mother know I loved her dearly, and it was nothing that I wouldn't do for her or she wouldn't do for me. I mean, I remember, you know, right up before the incident, my auntie was there, and I was sitting in my mom's lap, and she was rocking me like a baby, and my auntie was teasing, you know, how small I am, because I was the only kid, so.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we were really, really close.
And so that said, do you have questions about why you survived and your mother didn't?
I used to excuse me, question God about that, but, I mean, it's where she got shot at, in the stomach, you know, and all your internal organs are there. And then, you know, after just really analyzing the situation, you know, it's sad to say, but it was just her time to go. Whether she was going to go by a gunshot or a car or whatever, it's just what God had in the cards for her.
And I've heard people say that. You've had how many surgeries since the shooting?
Probably about 14, and about 7 of those were major surgeries.
You know, I've heard doctors say, whenever you have a surgery, it's a serious surgery. How do you muster up the guts to keep going under the knife? I mean, I know, you know, you want to get better and you want...
I had this little wooden cross that this man had made, and every time I would go to surgery, I would just always have that cross. And to me, I was putting my faith in God. I'm putting my faith in the doctor, that he came to work sober and in his right mind and prepared and ready to do his job. I mean, that's all I could do.
Mm.
That's all anybody can do when you're going on, you know, you're going to be asleep.
Yeah, true, very true. So are you done with surgeries or are there still more to come?
I mean, there may be some more down the road, but, I just don't have the time really to take off for the recovery of, you know, after the surgery.
Was it easier at first to hide behind the bandages than it was to completely uncover the bandages and expose the face to the public?
Oh, that was so easy to hide behind the bandages. But as the surgeries went on, you know, I could no longer hide behind the bandage. I had to come from behind it.
So the bandages kind of gave you what type of security? Just kind of like a, you know, you didn't have to share the whole experience over and over again, I guess, with everybody you came in contact with. It was just easier to have the bandages in front of you.
Right, yeah. I mean, it was just so much easier that way. And, you know, I just don't know. Maybe it became like a security blanket. I really just don't know why I got so comfortable behind them.
Wow. Are you shocked by how much you've been able to handle?
Yeah, when I think about it, you know, I think about where I came from and where I am now, and I think it's just, you know, the way my mom raised me, my grandma, you know, just to keep your faith in God. That's all you can do. It's just you do it day for day, put your faith in God, and pray that you make the right steps and the right choices, you know, as you go.
I absolutely agree. If you just tuned in, you've come center stage tonight for the Carolyn Thomas story. She is a domestic violence survivor who survived a gunshot to the face at point-blank range. Her story has been featured on Oprah, Larry King Live, The Insider, our local channel, KWTX in Waco, Temple and Killeen, as well as in print with the Dallas Morning News, People Magazine, Jet, the Associated Press, and many others. We're glad tonight that Carolyn decided to share her story with us. And we also want to say to anyone that is listening that may be suffering from domestic abuse, contact the Domestic Abuse Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE or 1-800-799-7233. Also, a reminder, y'all, the chat room is down tonight, but Carolyn has agreed to take questions. If you have a question or a comment for Ms. Carolyn Thomas, you need to get on the phone lines. Dial us up at 347-850-8390 and then press 1. You know, Carolyn, you tell your story, you know, how many times a year? I see so many, like, articles, and when I went researching for this, you have been everywhere. How many speaking engagements about this have you done a year? I mean, on a yearly basis, what do you do?
Well, when I first started speaking, it was, like, a lot. Like, I would just come home, unpack, wash, pack, leave. But it's kind of, you know, slowed down a little bit. Now, but most definitely, like, you know, during, of course, October, which is National Domestic Violence Month. And, you know, in between, like, you know, April and May and June, they have different type of domestic violence conventions. So it just depends on what's going on.
But each time you tell this story, do you feel like, you know, this is like I said earlier, a ministry, and that it is just your job to get out there and save as many women as you can?
Yes, that's exactly the way I feel. You know, I never get tired of telling it, and because I know it's going to save, you know, at least one person. It's going to touch at least one person, you know, in the crowd.
Mm.
You just never know.
And so do you get emails from people who are, you know, in the same situation as you are and not knowing what to do, and I guess at a point where they're afraid to leave, but, you know that it's time to go, but still just don't know how to get out?
Yeah, I get a lot of emails and stuff on Facebook, and, you know, I just tell them, you know, you need to have a plan. You know, contact your local shelter or center or the domestic violence hotline number. I would prefer for them to, you know, them call them and let them give a safety plan versus my safety plan and something goes wrong. So, you know, I'd rather that I just refer them to there for their safety plan.
Tell us about the foundation you established after the shooting.
It's called Voices for All, the Carolyn Thomas Foundation, and every year around school time, we do school supplies and uniforms, and I do interventions around town. I go into local churches and schools and stuff, talk about teen dating and different things, and just try to keep busy and keep the word out.
You know, one of the most shocking things I read in researching for this show was that you said that when you used to go to work, he would call you after you got off and tell you that you had 15 minutes to get home?
Well, it most of the time it would be like when I was out with my girlfriends, and, you know, different people live on different sides of the town, so there's no way that I could just drop people off within 15 minutes, but that's what he would say.
So if you didn't make it home in the 15 minutes, what would happen?
It would be an argument.
That's crazy. So he, and I use his word loosely, he allowed you to go out, but then would all of a sudden decide when it was time for you to come home and felt like you should make it in 15 minutes.
Yeah, 15 minutes. No Whataburger, no nothing. You know,
just
come straight home.
Wow. I'm shocked by that. So that, you know, and again, for anybody who may be dealing with that situation, Carolyn, was that a warning sign?
Yeah, there were warning signs all over the place. But you got to keep in mind that I thought that I could change him. You know, I thought that I could have him be the man that I wanted him to be, the man like my grandfather, the man like the man down the street, the man like any man other than what he was.
And I guess for the record, and maybe you can explain it to somebody who may be experiencing it too, you can't change nobody.
Nope, you cannot. I don't care how hard you try. You can't change anybody but yourself. I mean, that's all you can do.
And so in his rages, did he ever make sense with any of his anger? I mean, were you flirting with other men that gave him the reason? You know,
no, I was too afraid to flirt with men, afraid to just anything. I mean, even my own cousins, you know, it was just, I couldn't even talk to them, but I remember being out one time and sitting at the bar, and me and, you know, my girlfriend, we sitting there, and some guy walks up and put his number in my pocket. And I thought, at the time I knew what he was, you know, he had put the number in my pocket, but I went on with my talking and, you know, whatever else was going on. And somebody that happened to be watching what was going on and knew what type of person he was came to me and said, don't forget about that number in your pocket. And I was just like, wow. Like, where are you at that you're watching? But thanks for reminding me about it.
And so they knew that person that if you
were... Oh, a lot of people knew how he was. You know, I was around town. I wasn't Carolyn. I was Terrence's girl or Popeye's girl.
Now, I read somewhere, speaking of Popeye, y'all, Popeye is his nickname. I understand
yes.
that you had a tattoo with Popeye on it somewhere.
Yes, I did.
Girl, no.
Yeah, but it's gone now.
I probably would have taken Ajax and Brillo pads. Tell me.
No,
so you had it surgically removed?
No Ajax. It was surgically removed, and the reason that my surgeon removed it, because, you know, other than having to look in the mirror and, you know, deal with looking different, he didn't want me to have to just see that name on my neck every day. You know, that probably would have just made things horrible.
Yeah. That's what I think one of the articles said, you had a necklace on, and just above the necklace you could see the words Popeye.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, now that's one of those things that I can imagine you wake up and really want to kick yourself and go, oh, my God, I cannot believe I tattooed this
right.
murder. Yeah. When I read that, I was shocked by that. I thought, wow. And so, ladies, that's one reason never to tattoo someone's name on your chest or...
Never.
Never, ever put nobody else's name on your body, male or female. Don't do that. So... any life lessons, you know, that you can share with someone who may be just naive enough to believe that it could not happen to them? What would you tell them?
I would tell them that domestic violence, you know, it doesn't care what you look like, you know, how nice of a handbag you have, what kind of car you drive, it doesn't care.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it has no racial boundaries, period. And you know, when you see that first red flag, you know, pay attention. Nip it in the bud. I think a lot of times with women that I've learned, far as with myself being in an abusive relationship, once you let one thing slide, that first thing slide, that's just like saying, well, okay, you know, go ahead and do it again. And that's what happens. They do it again, and you okay it, or you let it slide, and it's just a repeated thing. So now I know as far as, you know, dating, hey, nip it in the bud in the beginning. When you get that first red flag, don't wait for the second one, just boom.
So are you saying, so that we're clear, that if someone is in a relationship and the man hits them, that first time is reason enough for them to say, I'm out of here?
I would. I mean, you know, that's what I would do. I mean, you know, and I've been following by that as far as, you know, with me meeting guys or choosing to date a person like that first flag. Like, you know, why wait for the second one?
I agree. I've heard women say, you know, married women, this is, that, you know, they'll be in a situation of domestic violence or something else that, you know, the man is doing that is totally unacceptable, and they'll say, well, but, you know, my marriage vow said forever, you know, that we're supposed to be together until death do us part. What do you say to someone who's married and dealing with this situation like what you were dealing with and thinking that they should stay just because they're married?
I mean, you know, God don't want you to be in no situation where you get killed or your kids get harmed. I mean, I'm sure he wouldn't want that, you to be in that situation. I mean, if it's not good for you, it's not good with God.
So you feel like God would never want us to put ourselves in harm's way for the sake of a relationship?
No. I mean, you know, you can do your marriage counseling and talk to your pastor. I'm not saying not do that. But then, you know, after you see that's not working, then yeah.
Were there any warning signs pre-dating that you could pass on to someone that maybe you missed, you know, when you were dating him, maybe something he said before y'all moved in together that was an indicator that there was going to be future problems?
Ooh, I would say just him being a quiet person, period.
Now,
you can't read a quiet person.
I hate quiet men. I'm just here to put it on the record. If you can't talk,
yeah, I mean, you
don't
can't
look
read
at me.
Him.
I agree. But so then, people who have trouble articulating their thoughts, or people who have a problem with speaking well, you know, to others, you know, I'm just going to say, I don't deal with it.
With any relationship, they're going to be on their good manners, which I learned is what they call the honeymoon phase. So if they crazy, they definitely not going to show you they crazy, you know, straight up. They're going to kind of bait you in a little bit and sneak it in on you a little bit at a time.
Share with us some of the things that you've learned in counseling that can help the rest of us.
Oh, let's see. You know, that none of us are mind readers. We're not mind readers. We don't know what other people are thinking. And, you know, if they're saying one thing and their actions read another, you know, you need to pay attention to that. Like I did with the, you know, if you leave me, I'll kill you. I thought, okay, yeah, right, you know. But really, in his mind, he was dead serious. But in my mind, I thought he was playing.
You said that to me, and I found that very odd. You say, when he told me that, you just blew right by that. I mean, no stop signs, no red flags, no caution signs.
Yeah.
It didn't even faze you that he was.
I just thought, you know what, he just being silly. Like, that's silly. Like, that's just, you know.
Did his mood change when he would say those words?
I mean, he may have, like, a certain expression on his face, but, you know, his mood wouldn't change.
Did he have a history of mental illness? Was he, like, ADHD or anything?
not that I know of, you know.
Just mean.
You know, I really don't even know what it was with me because, you know, I've asked several people that's dated him and they said that they never experienced it. I mean, one girl said she did, but for the most part, most of them didn't. But from what I've heard from his friends and several other people, that like I was the cutest girl that he's ever dated.
Oh.
And so, you know, the fear of, you know, losing that may have something to do with it.
Wow.
So he was, you know, I mean, he was a nice looking. Let's just be honest.
So was he a drug user, alcohol? Did he use alcohol to use drugs?
I mean, later on in the relationship, yeah, he abused drugs.
And you said that you thought he ran a detail business, but in fact, the detail business was just a front.
Right. Front for them to sell drugs. I mean, if you pulled up, you wouldn't know the difference. You would see what I saw. People getting their cars vacuumed, people getting their car washed, stuff like that. So, yeah.
So this guy just had so many layers that you just were not picking up on.
No, but you know what? Now my eyes are so wide open that, you know, I just can pick it out before it even happens. Like, I just don't even give it a chance. And he, you know, taught me a lot of stuff in that relationship as to how to pick.
How to
read. You know, just read people. Yeah, just don't even have to go through the red tape and the crap. Like, let's just get to the good part. Like, you know.
Wow. And I can understand that. I can definitely understand. And I would think that would change. The experience itself would change the way you look at people, period. Maybe you're not as trusting anymore?
Oh, no, I'm not as trusting. My uncle said that I've gotten meaner, which I have. Everything used to be okay and when it wasn't okay. And so if it's not okay, then it's just not okay. And you're just going to have to accept that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it is now.
So you tell people what you think now as opposed to sugarcoating it?
Yeah, and that's something that I got to work on because I have become a little too outspoken, and sometimes it may come off a little rough. So even though I try to think, like, okay, I'm going to say it like this, and, you know, like here, maybe back in January, sometimes I take in women that are in an abusive relationship, and I took in a young lady, and I was trying to figure out how to explain to her about a situation. And, yeah, so that's something I got to work on.
But I would think, you know, we all are, you know, a result of what we've been through. And you've been through a lot. And I think, you know, nobody can really blame you for being just a little, you know, rougher, you know, and more protective of yourself.
Right.
Yeah. And so I'm sure now when you think about how, you know, he approached you and, you know, the things that he said that were warning signs, what would you say to someone who is, you know, meeting someone for the first time? You know, what kind of questions, what kind of things should they be looking for? You know, what kind of things should be red flags?
One day on a plane, we came up with, like, three questions to ask. Like, have you ever been to prison? Have you ever been tested? And have you ever hit a woman?
Tested for?
That's just, like, three questions to ask your date.
I'm saying, you said, have you ever been tested? Tested for what?
HIV.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. So she asked the date on her first date, she asked I'm sorry. Where is that going to take her?
That's just like me and a friend were coming back from a speech, and we were on the plane, and we were just like, well, what are some questions that you know, if you were on a date that you would like to ask him? And that's just what I came up with.
And, you know, and I can see where you're going with that. It's kind of like you don't sugarcoat it anymore. Now you just ask. And if the answer does not come back right, you just know to move on.
Exactly.
Okay, I get that, and I completely get that. So you're saying to women today, don't be desperate. You know,
right?
Ask the right questions, and if he answers them wrong, flag, move on. Don't waste your time.
Right. Right.
Wow. Okay. So you came up with that. So if he does not have the right tone or appears to maybe be easily agitated or controlling, how should she know then what to do? Does she delve deeper into why is he controlling, or does she ask more questions?
No, just, you know, if he's showing he's controlling, then you just, you know, kindly let him down, you know.
Okay.
Text your friend and tell her to call and say it's an emergency.
And I understand that. Here in Dallas, and I don't know if you heard this story, a lady was killed some time back, and she repeatedly called 911 and said, you know, my ex-husband is stalking me. I think he's going to kill me. He's told me he's going to kill me. And 911, they just kind of gave her some advice. And for the record, ladies, and I found this out in research for our previous show, the police are not there to protect you. They respond to crimes. So what do you say to someone who's in fear of their life? What is a plan? I mean, if you feel like someone's stalking you or whatever, what do you
say
to do?
You know, most definitely get you some kind of self-defense class, some kind of karate class. And if you're up to it and you can stand for it, get in a gun handling class. Like, I took a gun handling class once I was able to hear the gunshot. You know, I got in and learned how to work a gun.
Protect yourself.
Right.
Right. Because a lot of times, you know, when people have made their escape, then they're in fear of their lives, you know, that this person is going to come back. And this particular lady that I just spoke of, the person did eventually kill her. But she said she'd made like 100 phone calls to 911. So the police are not going to be available to protect you. They can't give you 24-hour protection. So you have to have a plan.
Yeah, and learn your gun laws and, you know, get you some karate, something. mm-hmm. to protect yourself. You know, I think all women should take some kind of self-defense class.
Mm-hmm. And so when you see people today and they tell you their stories and they're not prepared to leave, do you feel a sense of urgency for them?
Yes, I do.
And
that's when I try to break out the big guns. Then I'm showing them the pictures of me without my bandages. And, you know, I thought this person wasn't going to do this, but look what they did. This person said they love me. Look what they did. Look what I caused my family to go through. I lost my mom. I lost my grandma. I lost my auntie. All behind, a domestic violence situation. And I let them know, you don't want to go through this. You don't want to wake up every day and, you know, not be able to speak to your mom, you know, not being able to, you know, talk to her or talk to your kids. So in order for you to still be able to do that, you got to get out of this situation before it escalates.
But isn't one of the main warning signs that most women who are victims of domestic violence miss is that love does not hurt?
Yeah. Nope, healthy love doesn't hurt. It doesn't.
And I think that's one of the main things that when you find a woman who justifies domestic violence, what do you say to her? Like she feels like it's her fault, or maybe she did something wrong, or if she had only not done such and such, this wouldn't have occurred. What do you say to her?
I just let her know that it's not, you know, it's not your fault. Like you did nothing wrong to the point of where somebody wants to try to kill you and take your life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because I think women, we got to stop, you know, anytime somebody is, you know, outweighing you by 50 or 60 pounds and they use your face as a punching bag or, you know, bounce you off of walls, that's just not healthy love, you know.
No,
and it's just not healthy. And I think for some reason we forget that, you know, as women, and like you said, we confuse jealousy with love, and that's dangerous whenever you begin to confuse those two because they are opposite of each other.
Right.
Yeah. And so when he would act, or maybe he really was jealous, but when he would do that, did he really ever seem remorseful? Really? I mean, you said he apologized, but did he really seem like he was really sorry?
If somebody is really sorry or really remorseful, then they don't repeat that act over again.
I agree. That's just, it's just amazing. Well, Carolyn, we're down to our last 13 minutes of the show. We're going to give you an opportunity to just give us a little of the speeches that you give to people who are, part of your conferences and groups that you go and meet with and you try to share with them some of the wisdom that you've learned through this situation. What do you tell them?
It really just depends on the crowd. If it's a crowd of, you know, women, I'm just going to let them know, you know, period, point blank, get out of that relationship, get you a safety plan, you know, figure out what you need to do to save yourself and your family. And if it's a crowd of teenagers, my main advice, like what our drill is, listen to your parents. Listen to your guardian. Listen to your grandparents. Whoever it is telling you something, listen to them because they're telling you that for a reason, because they love you. It's not because they don't want you to see a good, have a good time or enjoy yourself. It's because they've already experienced some of the things in life that you're about to go through. So they're going to try to prevent you from those life lessons like I had to go through.
Isn't there, can people donate to your foundation?
Yes, they can.
How do they do that?
Just go to the website, www.carolyn-thomas.org, and there is a deal there for, you click on donations, and it goes through a PayPal account.
Is there a way someone can reach out to you if they didn't want to talk to you on the air but want to talk to you privately?
Yeah, they can, The website has an email. It has several, I think two email addresses. And Either way, my PR person, if they, you know, send it through her email, she'll get it, or they send it to me, I'll get it.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to write a book?
I have been trying to write a book and, you know, been hoping on it, but it's just, I guess, a matter of finding somebody that wants to write it or publish it. Really, it's the publishers that I'm having the issue with.
Wow. So you've already finished it and you're just looking for a publisher?
Well, I have somebody that is going to write it for me.
Mm-hmm. Like a ghostwriter?
Yes.
Really?
Actually, the gentleman that did the People magazine article.
Really?
Yeah. But so we just haven't had any luck with anybody wanting to publish it, like, you know.
Wow. So, I mean, I would think your story is one worth telling. What kind of roadblocks are you running into?
I just, you know, I don't know. I just know that it's a publishing issue. I mean, I've been to Lifetime and Oxygen and different channels. I don't know. I don't know if maybe God don't want me to take this route or it's just not time. I don't know.
But are you trying to do it like a documentary or are you trying to do it as a book?
I would like to do a book and then a Lifetime story.
Wow. You know what? And I would think, and you just might be right on that, maybe God doesn't want you to go that route yet. Don't you think to dredge that up and see that put on film would be really hard? I mean, talking about it is one thing, but to see it portrayed for the way it really was, wouldn't that be hard?
I think sometimes you have to reach people, you know, different ways. You know, some people may get it from reading a book. Some people may get it from actually, you know, seeing it on TV and actually going through it, you know, versus me telling them what I went through. It's just because it's just different people you can reach different ways.
Did you have a strong support system from your church family when this happened?
At the time, I wasn't really, I didn't have, like, a church home.
Wow.
I visited certain churches, but I didn't have a church home at the time.
Because I would have thought that during that time, you would have really needed some strong coaching from a spiritual standpoint to get you through it. Did you have anybody in your life that came to you from that?
I mean, my grandmother would be that, and my aunt, you know, my grandmother was a diehard Pentecostal, and so was my aunt. And my aunt, you know, she kind of, I don't know the proper word to use for her, so I'm just going to say she had a vision about what was going to happen, and she told me about it, and I kind of ignored her. Like, she, you know, and Jessie Mae don't know, but Jessie Mae really knew, and she didn't speak for me for some time because she had warned me.
No.
Yeah.
So your aunt had a vision or premonition or a dream?
I'm trying to think of kind of like an evangelist, like, you know, she, I don't want to say God shows her things and then people take that the wrong way, but, you know, God showed her.
God show people things.
What was the, huh?
God does show people things.
Well, God showed her what was going to happen, and she told me about it, and I ignored her, and she didn't speak to me probably for about 2 years. I mean, I could call her, and she would just be just as dry,
yeah.
And I finally just had to ask her for forgiveness. Like, I didn't know, and I apologize for, you know, thinking that you didn't know what you were talking about and that your visions and stuff that you have wasn't true.
How did she describe what was going to happen?
I think her exact words was, he's going to do something terrible, and he's going to go away for a long time.
Oh. So she was saying he's going to do something terrible to you, or he's just going to do something terrible?
He's going to do something terrible to me.
Oh, my goodness. And you didn't believe her? You just didn't, I mean, you didn't feel anything when she said that?
I mean, I know people in our family spoke with her, and, you know, and you know, she would, you know, tell them her visions if she had one and give them scriptures to read in the Bible. But I just thought, you know, just like kind of like how I did my mom and my grandmother, I kind of just blew her off as if she didn't know what she was talking about.
Wow. Carolyn, you have an amazing story. And honest to God, I have really felt like I've grown an inch since talking to you. I mean, really, because, you know, we all have something we're going through, y'all. We all do. And Carolyn has inspired me beyond what she will ever know from telling her story to me this week. So, you know, I definitely thank you so much for that. Carolyn, tell them again how to reach out to you if they want to talk to you off the air, if they want to make a donation to your foundation. Tell them again how to reach out to you.
They can go to the website, which is www.carolyn-thomas.org. I'm on Facebook as well. So a lot of people Facebook me. I'm on Twitter as well. So you can reach out to me at those websites.
Well, thank you, Carolyn, for being with us tonight. Y'all, that was Carolyn Thomas. What a story she has to tell. I hope you all got something from it. I definitely did. And again, we want to remind anyone who may be a victim of domestic abuse, please reach out to the Domestic Violence Hotline. The number is 1-800-799-SAFE or 1-800-799-7233. Again, 1-800-799-SAFE. If you are currently going through a situation of domestic violence or domestic abuse, reach out and get yourself some help. Don't let your story be a story like the one Carolyn told us tonight. Also, a reminder, y'all, we are here each and every Friday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Central, 9 to 11 Eastern, doing what we do best. That's telling stories like the one we told tonight of Carolyn's story. Also telling hot topics that are in the news. If you like what we do here on Center Stage and you'd like to advertise with us, send us an email this week at centerstageradio@yahoo.com. Again, if you like what we do here at Center Stage, drop us a line at centerstageradio@yahoo.com. We'd love to have you. Also, y'all, I'm sorry the chat room is down tonight. I apologize. I am just not feeling the chat room. The last time we had it open, we had such negative comments, and then we I would like to call them haters. And so we have not had the chat room open for a while, and then we started experiencing some technical difficulties. And so it just hasn't been open. I'm sorry. Listen, we got to get out of here, y'all. But again, we'd like to say thank you to Ms. Carolyn Thomas for stopping by tonight and telling her story, and what a story it was. And also we'd like to thank you, the audience, for listening. Appreciate you so much for coming and hanging out with us every week. Listen, guys, we got to get out of here. We got to make way for somebody else to do what we do. Okay, y'all, we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.